This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Thai authorities on a hunt for suspects wanted in this week's deadly Bangkok bombing. The International Criminal Court to reconsider Kenya's lack of cooperation in President Kenyatta's trial. Primordial landscapes echo nature's power.
Iceland is a really active place geologically, and so it's kind of like you're seeing things form that took geologic time kind of right before you.
Some big honors for two leading ladies of country music. These and other stories just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. Thai authorities have issued an arrest warrant for a foreign man wanted in a bombing that killed at least 22 people Monday at a Bangkok shrine. Authorities released a sketch of the suspect, a young man wearing a yellow shirt with black shaggy hair, stubble, and round plastic frame glasses. Grainy security camera footage showed him leaving a backpack under a bench and calmly walking away from the scene shortly before the bomb exploded. A police spokesman says two other men, one seen wearing red and another wearing white, are also suspects in the attacks. My colleague Sarah Williams spoke with our Bangkok correspondent Steve Herman about the attack and about how Bangkok residents are trying to resume normal life.
The national police chief is describing the bomber as likely being part of a network, but there's been leaks from the police authorities to domestic media hinting that they could have possibly been connected to Uyghurs who are upset with Thailand because of the Thai government's recent deportation of some Uyghurs who were asking for refugee status. But there's not a single credible analyst who is giving much credence to that particular theory. A number of other specialists, analysts who are Thai, are saying that this is most likely a domestic type of operation.
Now, meanwhile, the Erawan Shrine, I believe, has reopened.
Yes, we were out there. It was very hot, and a number of tourists did show up, along with some members of victims' families. And in addition, now people are not only making offerings for the statue, the Thai version of the Hindu god Brahma, who is the god of creation, and people usually go there and ask for help with finding a better job or in their studies or even to get pregnant. But now they're also offering prayers for the souls of those who were killed on Monday night.
And what is the atmosphere like in Bangkok following this devastating attack earlier this week?
Well, it's on edge, obviously. And then on Tuesday, we had this something thrown off of a bridge near a pier into the Chao Phraya River and created quite a boom, although nobody was killed. Conflicting information from the police on whether that's related to the Monday night blast or not. So people are waiting to see, was this just one incident, although it's unprecedented to ever have had a bomb like this directed, especially in the middle of a tourist district. And so people are very much on edge, wondering what's going to happen. And tourists are canceling trips. Other people are cutting their trips short and leaving Bangkok because of concern. So this is immediately affecting the tourism industry here, which is quite vital to the economy.
VOA Bangkok correspondent Steve Herman speaking with International Edition Sarah Williams. You can see video of Steve's latest reports from Bangkok by logging on to our website at www.voanews.com. Turning to social media reaction to the Bangkok bombing, International Edition's G. Abby Lee is here to tell us how the Twitter world is responding to the news. Hello, G.
Hi, Ray. The U.S. State Department was one of the first to send condolences to the victims. The State Department's Bureau of East Asian and Pacific Affairs is on Twitter at U.S. Asia Pacific. The account sent out a tweet Tuesday, and it reads like this. Thoughts and prayers with hashtag Bangkok explosion victims, friends, and families. We're monitoring developments, checking if any Americans are hurt. That's been retweeted more than 100 times. The EAP office also shared a tweet from the American ambassador to Thailand, Patrick Murphy. He wrote, paying our respects for the victims and families from the hashtag Bangkok Blast, hashtag Stronger Together.
I see. And speaking of which, what are some of the trending hashtags on the blast?
Well, there are two. Hashtag Bangkok Blast, the one that I just mentioned, was used in some 19,000 tweets during the last 24 hours. And hashtag Bangkok Bombing was used in a little over 1,000 tweets, according to the analytics website Topsy. Hashtag Stronger Together is a commonly used hashtag for tweets in the Thai language.
At least 22 people have been killed. Any word on the makeup of the nationalities involved?
Ray, among foreign victims, the Chinese might make up the largest bracket. China's state-run CCTV at CCTV News on Twitter tweeted that its embassy in Thailand confirmed 7 Chinese nationals have been killed from the blast. Xinhua News Agency at XH News also tweeted the same confirmation. Ray?
Thanks for the update, G. That was G. Abby Lee, and she's on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. That's JEEABBEYLEE. And you can also comment on our website at www.voanews.com. This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA Podcasts a try.
VOANews.com.
Visit our website at VOANews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA Podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Ahead of a crucial U.S. congressional vote on the Iran nuclear deal expected next month, 4 more Democratic senators have announced their support of the pact over the past 2 days. The ranking member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, New Jersey's Robert Menendez, is not one of them. He said in a speech Tuesday he will vote against it.
In essence, we thought the agreement would be rollback for rollback. You roll back your infrastructure, and we'll roll back our sanctions. And at the end of the day, what we appear to have is a rollback of sanctions, and Iran only limiting its capability, but not dismantling or rolling it back. So what do we get? We get an alarm bell should they decide to violate their commitments, and a system for inspections to verify their compliance. Is that, in my view, is a far cry from significant dismantling.
Senator Menendez's refusal to endorse the Iran nuclear agreement comes 2 weeks after the Senate's third-ranking Democrat, Chuck Schumer of New York, broke ranks with President Obama, saying he will reject the deal. International Edition's Victor Beatty has more.
Regional analyst Ian Lustig of the University of Pennsylvania told me critics like Senator Menendez failed to offer a viable alternative to the agreement with Iran.
Critics such as Senator Menendez don't offer an alternative. They act as if there's a better plan out there to make it less likely that Iran would eventually get a nuclear weapon, or less likely that Iran would, in some other ways, be less troublesome to the United States. The fact is that the purpose of the negotiations was to reduce as much as possible the threat of destabilization of the Middle East, including, and one of those threats is an Iranian nuclear weapons. This deal, obviously, really to almost all real experts, is the best way forward. Certainly it prevents Iran from having a nuclear weapon for 8 to 10 years, if not more, and in that time makes it possible to engage that country in a way that will disincentivize it from moving forward toward a nuclear weapons capacity. The options of letting this agreement die and giving Iran essentially a carte blanche politically to go for a bomb as quickly as it wants to is the obvious alternative, especially since the United States stands alone against the entire rest of the UN Security Council, which has unanimously endorsed this arrangement. So the sanctions regime would collapse, the United States would be isolated, and Iran, faced with an aggressive talk from Israel, and which is armed with nuclear weapons, would probably have a much more confident and easier route to get a nuclear weapon than it would under these terms of this agreement.
If lawmakers reject the agreement in this resolution of disapproval and the president has to veto it, is that politically difficult for him?
No, it won't be politically difficult for him. He is expecting that that will happen. He would prefer it if it didn't get to the veto, but he'll definitely veto it. He's expecting that. Of course, if enough Democrats defect so that his veto is overridden, that would be a catastrophic loss for him, and I would say for the country.
Is there a sense that this agreement will go on whether or not Congress agrees to it or not?
Well, yes. I mean, Congress will not agree to it. The question is, what if Congress overcame the president's veto? Then the agreement between the rest of the world and Iran would go forward, and the Congress would try to stop it by ratcheting up sanctions. They probably wouldn't be able to do very much if the president stood in the way. But what would occur, since the congressional sanctions would still be in place, is that a new world economic order would start to develop in which the countries and businesses and corporations would be able to do business with Iran, because they would cut ties with America's banking system. And that would isolate us and punish us economically for standing on the sidelines.
Regional analyst Ian Lustig of the University of Pennsylvania speaking with International Edition's Victor Beatty. Meanwhile, the United States is expressing confidence in the International Atomic Energy Agency to probe Iran's alleged past efforts to build a nuclear bomb. The Associated Press, citing a leaked IAEA memo, reports the UN atomic watchdog will allow Iran to carry out its own inspections. AP says under the agreement, Iran itself will send its own inspectors and equipment to the Parchin nuclear site, where Iran's been suspected of trying to develop a nuclear weapon. The IAEA is also scheduled to open a nuclear fuel bank in eastern Kazakhstan next week. The goal there is to store low enriched uranium for energy production in case of supply disruptions and to discourage countries from developing their own nuclear weapons technology. The Kazakh facility is the UN's agency's second fuel bank after one in Russia. Both are considered necessary to ease concerns that politics could become a problem. VOA's Daniel Scharf has more.
Once established, the reserves in Kazakhstan will hold up to 90 tons of low-enriched uranium, according to the IAEA, the nuclear watchdog of the United Nations. The bank will add to supplies of last resort already in Russia for use by countries having trouble sourcing nuclear fuel because of political tensions. Terry Wood is the IAEA's project director for the LEU Fuel Bank.
There have been some instances where supply has not been possible or at least threatened.
Concerns about energy dependence were raised in Ukraine after Russia annexed Crimea, began supporting rebels, and threatened to cut off gas supplies. Ukraine had been getting its nuclear fuel and materials from Russia, but began contracting some of it with a nuclear supplier in the United States. Kyiv also froze a joint plan with Moscow to build a nuclear fuel factory to supply its reactors. Anton Klopkov is director of Russia's Center for Energy and Security Studies and editor of the Nuclear Club Journal.
So from a political point of view, for them, it will be much easier to get this material from Kazakhstan.
The Kazakhstan bank will add to the IAEA's existing reserve of nuclear fuel at Russia's International Uranium Enrichment Center. The Russian government pays for the uranium reserve stored in Arkhangelsk, Siberia, while donors fund the bank in Kazakhstan. U.S. public and private funds covered two-thirds of the costs, while the rest was paid for by the European Union, United Arab Emirates, Kuwait, and Norway. The fuel reserves dissuade countries from developing nuclear power by enriching their own uranium, a costly process that could also be used for making weapons-grade material. Full IAEA safeguards and inspections apply to both the Russian and Kazakhstan fuel banks, as well as the uranium taken out by members. Daniel Scherf, VOA News, Moscow.
Still to come, Iceland revealed. This is VOA.
From Science and Technology, here's What's New.
What's new? An electronic jacket for motorcyclists. It's a motorcycle safety vest fitted with bright indicator lights that increase the visibility of the motorcyclist. An intention to turn is indicated as usual on the bike's indicator lights, but also on the back of the jacket. The jacket is hooked up to the bike's electronics. In bustling cities like Nairobi in Kenya, more and more people are using motorcycle taxis to get around. Joseph Kariuki has been a motorcycle taxi operator for 5 years.
Many of our people die, most deaths being caused by motor vehicles on the road.
Kenya's National Transport Authority says an average of 3,000 people are killed on Kenyan roads each year, many involving motorcycles. Charles Muchene is the CEO of the wearable tech company Chadlight.
One of the ideas that came up is to increase the visibility of an individual motorcyclist by just elevating their indication system.
For VOA's What's New, I'm Todd Grossons.
You are listening to VOA's International Edition, coming to you from Washington. The International Criminal Court will re-examine whether Kenya failed to cooperate in a case of crimes against humanity against Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta. Lisa Bryant reports from Paris on Wednesday's ruling by appeals judges at the Hague-based court.
Thank you, Madam President. The situation in the Republic of Kenya in the case of the prosecutor versus Uhuru Muigai Kenyatta.
The appeals decision refers to whether Kenya obstructed evidence that International Criminal Court prosecutors say they needed to build their case against Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta. Presiding Judge Sylvia Fernandez read the decision that concludes trial judges made mistakes.
The appeals chamber finds that the trial chamber erred in the exercise of its discretion by conflating the non-compliance proceedings against Kenya with the criminal proceedings against Mr. Kenyatta, by failing to address whether judicial measures had been exhausted, and by assessing the sufficiency of evidence and the conduct of the prosecutor in an inconsistent manner.
President Kenyatta had been charged as an indirect co-perpetrator in violence following Kenya's 2007 election, but last December, ICC prosecutors dropped charges of crimes against humanity against him, accusing the Kenyan government of blocking their investigations. Mr. Kenyatta has maintained his innocence, and the government said it complied with prosecution demands. Judge Fernandez ordered the lower court to reconsider its decision not to report Kenya to the ICC's governing body for noncompliance. In Nairobi, Amnesty International's East Africa campaigner, Victor Odero, reacted cautiously, saying the rights group is waiting for the trial court's reconsideration of its ruling.
Amnesty International's position, of course, is that states have to respect and abide by the obligations under international human rights law. And this is, in fact, the matter that is to be determined, whether or not Kenya, in the first instance, abided by its obligations under the statute.
The ICC has made non-compliance referrals to the governing body before, including on cases dealing with Sudan, Chad, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. That body can then impose sanctions, but so far has not done so. Kenya's deputy president, William Ruto, is still on trial at the ICC on charges similar to those against Mr. Kenyatta. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Iceland is a tiny windswept nation on the edge of the Arctic Circle in the North Atlantic. Its raw beauty is the subject of a new photo exhibit at the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History here in Washington. VOA's Roseanne Skirbel takes us on a behind-the-scenes journey to explore how the country formed and continues to evolve.
Through the skilled eye of landscape photographer Feodor Pikarin, Iceland appears like an isolated planet from another galaxy.
Iceland is a really active place geologically, and so it's kind of like you're seeing things form that took geologic time kind of right before you.
Exhibit manager Jill Johnson says the photographs and primordial landscapes Iceland revealed tell the story of the power of nature to transform the planet.
So you're seeing these processes in action, and then you're watching as, say, a volcano erupts, and then you have new ground, and what starts to colonize, what takes over, what plants come in. You see a glacier sort of slowly melting, and as it scrapes away, what landscapes reveal.
These natural cycles are repeated before our eyes as nature etches a path through the terrain. We cross craggy ocean shores, hover over hot geysers, and gaze at the wonder of the northern lights in the sky. We are humbled by the power of the wind, hulking icebergs and rocks turn blue-green from geothermal activity inside the Earth. Pickering describes how he gets those shots.
A good day for me is when I will find maybe half a dozen locations where I think it's worth waiting for the right light, the right condition, waiting for all the subtle changes that happen with the cloud, the wind, the sunlight. Those are the things I wait for.
Iceland is a land of 30 active volcano systems. The largest erupted a year ago. Pickering was in the air and on the ground as the lava was flowing.
It was such a primordial scene coming into this scene. There was a huge column of dust blowing across this vast open stretch. And in the background, you could see the linear fires of this volcano spewing out in a long, long rift.
Pitcairn says these are more than beautiful pictures.
I try to capture something that is evocative, something that a person can, that resonates with the human spirit.
Iceland Revealed portrays a sense of wonder, which Pickering says communicates the urgency to protect wild places everywhere. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
It's been a good year for country music stars Carrie Underwood and Trisha Yearwood. They've both been picking up some big honors recently. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with VOA's Country Hits USA host Nikki Strong about Yearwood's latest success and how Underwood beat out some of the top names in country music to win her Teen Choice Awards.
Carrie Underwood wasn't there, but she found out that she won two Teen Choice Awards recently. Nikki, Carrie won for...
Choice Country Song.
Choice Country Song.
And Choice Country Artist.
And her songs were Something in the Water and Little Toy Guns.
Yep.
Yeah. She actually, she had to beat out some pretty high-profile people
Big
to get
time.
These things.
Yes, for the Choice Country Song, she had to beat out Luke Bryan and Florida Georgia Line and Hunter Hayes, Sam Hunt, and Megan and Liz.
Wow.
Yeah, and in the Choice Country Artist category, she had to defeat, again, Luke Bryan and Florida Georgia Line and Hunter Hayes, but also Miranda Lambert and Blake Shelton.
Wow. Those some pretty high-powered names.
Yes, she beat them all.
Now, she's also known for hosting the CMA Awards with Brad Paisley.
Yes.
And I understand that Carrie has signed up to do that again.
She'll be doing that again. This is like their 7th or 8th year
Something
doing
like
it together.
That. I think it's the 8th year.
Yeah.
And it's going to be broadcast in November.
November 4th.
And she and Brad are kind of the, you know, a comic relief team.
Yes.
In addition to being extremely talented musicians
yes.
and singers.
Yes. And she's working on new music. So who knows if something may be out around that time, she might perform it. She's actually planning on making a huge announcement. So we'll see what that announcement is.
Well, let's go to another very talented woman, Trisha Yearwood.
Trisha Yearwood. Well, she has another thing to add to her list of multiple accomplishments. She won the prestigious ASCAP Voice of Music Award.
Wow.
Yes. So this is a very prestigious award. It's given to songwriters and artists whose music gives voice to the spirit of a generation and who possess a unique style of creative genius that will inspire and enrich generations to come.
Wow. Now, was there any particular song, or was it for her entire body of work?
For her body of work.
Wow. Well, congratulations to Trisha, and I bet her husband, Garth Brooks, is all proud of her.
Well, you know, both her and him, they are getting, they're being inducted to Nashville's Music City Walk of Fame later on this month. So,
okay.
No, actually, next month. So it's going to be a special ceremony that's happening next month. And they are the first husband and wife team to receive that honor.
Wow. Well, we'll look for that. We might even post some photos of that on our Twitter feed. If you want to send us a tweet, you can send one to Nikki at VOA underscore music. And you can listen for Nikki, Country Hits USA. That's on our website, www.voanews.com.
That'll do it for this edition of International Edition. You can get more news and information on our website at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
The United States has expanded its offer of rewards for information on key leaders of terrorist organizations to include a leader of one of the groups conducting attacks on government facilities and other targets in northern Nigeria, roiling the nation in sectarian violence. Abu Bakr Shekau is the leader of the group commonly known as Boko Haram, a Nigeria-based extremist organization seeking to overthrow the current government there and replace it with a regime based on a strict interpretation of Islamic law. Links with terrorist groups such as Al-Qaeda and Al-Shabaab have strengthened Boko Haram's capacity to conduct its attacks. Previously, the group's number two, Shekau claimed overall command in July 2010, expressing solidarity with Al-Qaeda and threatening the United States. A vehicle bomb attack on the United Nations headquarters in Abuja in August 2011 marked the group's first lethal operation against Western interests, killing at least 23 people and injuring 80 others. In April 2012, the group bombed a Nigerian newspaper office in Abuja and later threatened other local and international news outlets, including The Voice of America. Under his leadership, the group has kidnapped hundreds of children to serve as hostages, bearers, and even fighters, most recently in the northeastern town of Damasak. Shekau is tall, slim, and has a dark complexion. He was born in Yobe, Nigeria, sometime between 1965 and 1975, and is of the Kanuri ethnicity. He speaks Arabic, Hausa, Fulani, and Kanuri. He is known to have used the aliases Abu Bakr Sikwa and Imam Abu Bakr Shiku. The Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $7 million for information leading to Shekau's location. The U.S. promises that all credible reports will be investigated and the identity of all informants will be kept confidential. If appropriate, the U.S. is prepared to protect informants by relocating them and their families. If you have information on this man, contact the nearest U.S. embassy or consulate or submit a tip to www.rewardsforjustice.net. or email information to info@rewardsforjustice.net. You may also call the Rewards for Justice tip line at 1-800-877-3927.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.
It's 4 hours universal time. Stay tuned.